paranoia. We will also consider the environment in which these two Jedi have been raised.
So, would it be fair to say that you think that because the Horn siblings are the children of a Corellian Jedi Master and the grandchildren of a well-known smuggler, these factors might have caused this mental condition?
Don't go putting words into my mouth, Tia,
Dala admonished, but there was no real ire in her tone.
I simply said we would consider the environment in which they were raised, that's all.
Do you think this is a hitherto unknown manifestation of simply being Jedi?
Tyr plowed on, although Dala had turned away and was looking at another reporter with his hand imploringly raised. By this point, Yakiel's hand had closed on her lightsaber, as had Barb's, although he grunted with pain at the effort. A flippered hand touched her wrist, slightly moist, cool, and sending calm through the Force.
Don't, said Silgall in a quiet voice. Don't give them any more ammunition to use against us. I, for one, have heard enough, and I dare say that we'll be seeing this particular speech played and replayed often enough on the Holonet that we can pick up anything we've missed. Come, let us get Basil treated, and we will talk.
Yakiel growled softly and nodded. Silgall spoke wisdom, although it pained the Bothan to sit by and listen to such disgusting things being said about Valen and Gisela's parentage.
To think anyone would stoop that low,
she muttered, and turned to follow the other Jedi. She moved to one side of Barv, smiling reassuringly up at him as she slipped his arm around her shoulders to assist him as he walked. Silgall was on his other side. They and the other Jedi who had emerged from the temple moved steadily, unobtrusively back toward their sanctuary, but apparently not unobtrusively enough.
Jedi!
Came Javis Tyr's voice. Yakiel froze in her tracks. Barv turned his massive head to regard the reporter. In his grunting, guttural language, he chided Tyr for not covering the news impartially and for clearly harboring a bias. Such behavior, Barv said, was not becoming for a journalist, and Tyr should know better. While the rebuke was mild, the Ramoan language always sounded as if the speaker were trying to take someone's head off verbally, and Tyr, clearly not understanding a word of it, recoiled ever so slightly.
Do you have any comments on Admiral Dala's speech? I witnessed the fight between you two and Gisela Horn. I take it you were trying to stop her. Can you tell us why? How much of a threat is she? How far-reaching is this strange mental illness?
Silgall, displaying more patience in her right flipper than Yakiel had in her entire furry body, stepped forward before the Bothan could retort.
The Jedi are obviously very concerned about the current state of events, and have been since the first incident. We are doing everything we can.
She gave him a smile, and then turned decisively back toward the temple. Yakiel knew she shouldn't, but she couldn't resist casting one more glowering glance over her shoulder at Javis Tyr.
This can't be good, she murmured.
Dala leaned back into the comfortable nerf-hide upholstery of her chauffeured speeder inside, running a hand through her hair. Across from her sat her personal assistant, Wynn Dorvan, slight, nondescript, but always looking completely pulled together with not a brown hair out of place. He had become invaluable to her over the last year and a half. So invaluable that she had relaxed regulations and permitted him to allow his pet Chitlick to accompany him from time to time. It perched on his shoulder now, a small, orange-striped marsupial from Ord Cestus that had become all the rage as a pet. It was quiet, litter-trained, and had a tendency to find a dark place to sleep most of the day, so the little creature was not much of a distraction for either Dorvan or Dala. It had been Dorvan who had been scanning the Holonet when the coverage began, and he who had notified her of what was happening. Now he glanced up at her, calm and yet eager, his data pad in his hands as he awaited her comments and perhaps further instructions. The Chitlick snuffled at his ear, then jumped down and curled up quietly beside him.
Well done, Dorvan, she said. I don't know how you managed to get the GA on this so fast. It was completely under control by the time I even got here, and we didn't waste a moment.
Jedi mind tricks,
he deadpanned, his thin lips only cracking into a smile when he saw the amusement on his employer's face.
Careful who you joke about that with,
Dala said, sobering.
While I can't complain about the political leverage incidents like this provide, it is troublesome. I have always had my issues with the Jedi.
There were many things and people and organizations she'd had issues with. The Jedi had almost had to get in line, but she'd had her eye on them for a while.
Keep them in their box, away from politics, and certainly never arm them,
she'd once said to a bounty hunter, Boba Fett. Now that she was in a position to do precisely that, it seemed more and more like a good policy.
It is certainly convenient that there's reason to tighten the reins on them, but it's more than that. What's going on with them now?
She sighed and shook her head, her unbound hair waving gently, and peered out the tinted reinforced transparisteel window. Dorvan dropped a hand to pet the sleeping animal beside him and waited patiently as she gathered her thoughts.
This is dangerous and unpredictable, and I don't like what I can't predict. They're far too powerful to simply be allowed to run amok like this. If they can't even control their own members, they are a very real threat, one that has to be contained for the greater good.
Wynn nodded, not necessarily agreeing. His approval carried no weight, and both he and she knew that, but in acknowledgement of her words. Master Kent Hamner wishes to meet with you tomorrow. Will you be available? Dala considered for a moment.
No,
she said.
Isn't my schedule too tightly booked for that?
Again, the ghost of the not-quite-grin. It is indeed. You couldn't possibly spare him any time for at least... He entered some data and looked up at her inquiringly. 3 more days? Gisela Horn would be locked away like her brother within the hour. Hamner would have to arrange a meeting with his fellow masters and probably, frankly, contact Luke Skywalker, even though it violated the terms of Luke's exile. That shouldn't take more than a day or two, given that most of the masters seemed to be sticking close to Coruscant these days. So that would give her 1-2 days to leave the Jedi Council stewing and fretting. Long enough to work in her favor. Not so long that she looked like she was neglecting a duty.
Perfect,
she said.
I wonder if I should promote you, Wynn.
She graced him with a smile that still managed to disconcert men of almost all ages. Oh, please don't, ma'am, he said, sounding utterly sincere. Right where I am is just perfect. Any higher and I'd have to have someone under me, and that just wouldn't do. Dala laughed.
Chapter 5. Kesh, 2 years earlier.
The ocean sighed as it rushed forward and receded in a rhythm, even more ancient than what was unfolding on its lavender sand shores. While the sun was bright and warm, a breeze came from the sea to cool the heated faces of the two figures standing there. They faced each other, as still as if they were carved from stone, the only motion around them that of their hair and heavy black robes as the wind toyed with them. Then, as if by some unheard signal, one of them moved. The soft sound of the ocean was punctuated by a sharp snap hiss. The almost perfectly symmetrical, light purple features of Vistara Kai's adversary were abruptly cast into a sickly green relief. Vistara activated her own weapon with a fluid motion, saluted her opponent with it, settled into position, and waited to see who would make the first move. She balanced lightly on the balls of her booted feet, ready to leap left, right, or straight up. Still, her opponent did not move. The sun was at its height, and its light was harsh, beating down on them like something physical. Their heavy, dark robes were stifling hot. But Vistara would no sooner abandon her robes than she would abandon her weapon or her heritage. The robes were traditional, ancient, a deep and valued part of who she was, and she would endure the encumbrance. The tribe valued strength as much as it valued beauty, rewarded patience as much as initiative. The wise being was the one who knew when which was called for. Vistara sprang, not at her opponent, but to the left and past him, leaping upward, turning in the air, and slashing outward with the blade. She felt the blade impact and heard its distinctive sizzle. he gasped as she landed, flipped, and crouched back into a defensive position. The sandy surface was treacherous, and her foot slipped. She righted herself almost instantly, but that moment was all he needed to come at her. He hammered her with blows that were more of strength than grace, his lithe body all lean muscle. She parried each strike, the blades clashing and sizzling, and ducked underneath the final one. Lightness and agility were her allies, and she used them freely. Her long, light brown hair had come loose from its quickly twisted braid, and the tendrils were a distraction. She blew upward to clear her vision just in time to block another one of the strong blows.
"Blast!"
she muttered, leaping back and switching the blade to her other hand. She was completely ambidextrous.
"You're getting good, Ari."
Ari Ross, apprentice, member of the native and conquered species of Kashiri, and Vistara Kai's close friend, offered her a smile.
"I'd say the same about you, Ves, except for the fact that the sand jump messes you up every single time."
She interrupted him with a sudden upward leap, landing on his shoulders, balancing there lightly with the use of force, and plunged the lightsaber straight downward, aiming for his back between his shoulder blades. He dived forward, force pushing her off, but not before she touched the tip of the glowing red blade to his robes. Ari arched, his dive thrown off as his body twisted from the pain. Even the training lightsabers inflicted a powerful shock. Vistara leapt as Ari dived, using his force push to her own advantage, turning twice in the air and landing surely, facing him. She smirked in satisfaction as she brushed her renegade locks out of the way. Ari completed his dive and came to his feet, rolling in the sand. Vistara extended her arm with the grace of a dancer. Ari's lightsaber was snatched from his hand and flew into hers. She grasped it and dropped into the Jarkai stance, ready to come at him with both blades. Ari looked up and sighed, dropping back into the sand.
"And you get distracted far too easily. Focus, Ari. Focus,"
she chided. She gestured casually, just a slight jerk of her chin, and a handful of sand flew toward Ari's face. Muttering, he lifted his empty hand and used the force to deflect the grains.
"He's just training, Ves,"
he muttered, getting to his feet and dusting himself off.
"It's never just training,"
she shot back. She deactivated her training lightsaber, hooked it back on her belt, and tossed Ari's to him. The Kashiri youth caught it easily, still looking disgruntled. Vistara undid her hair and fluffed it for a minute, letting the air penetrate to the roots to help cool her scalp. Her long fingers busily rebraided it, properly this time, as she continued to speak, while Ari shook grains of purple sand out of his own white shoulder-length hair.
"How often have I told you that? Say that in the presence of one of the masters, and you'll never make it beyond a Tyro."
Ari sighed and rose, nodding to acknowledge the truth of what she said. Neither of them had been formally chosen as an apprentice yet, although they had been training in classes under the tutelage of various masters for years, their strengths and weaknesses in the Force noted and analyzed and pushed. Vistara knew that at 14, it was still possible, even likely, that she would be chosen by a master as his or her formal apprentice. But she chafed horribly at the delay. Some Tyros were chosen at much younger ages, and Vistara knew that she was strong in the Force. She reached out for a flask of now warm water, and the canteen resting on the sand floated to her, the lid unfastening as it moved. Vistara gulped down the liquid thirstily. Sparring at the height of the sun was exhausting, and Ari always muttered about it, but she knew it toughened her. Vistara handed the canteen to Ari, who also drank. She regarded him for a moment. He was a nearly perfect physical specimen of a species whose physical strength, agility, and harmony of features and form had become an ideal for her own people. He could easily pass for a member of her own species. He would make a striking human, but a human nonetheless, were it not for the pale purple cast to his skin. His eyes, too, were slightly larger than a human's, large and expressive. His shoulders were broad, his hips narrow, and there was not an ounce of superfluous fat on his frame. His face, though, was flushed a darker purple than usual because he was overheated, and his hair had far too much sand in it.
"That's two for two," she said. "You up for another round?"
She gave him a wicked grin, which was exaggerated by the small scar at the corner of her mouth, the scar that the tribe saw as a flaw. It was plain on her face, right out in the open. There was very little she could do to disguise it. Attempts had been made to heal it and correct it with cosmetic surgery. Those attempts had been mostly successful, and now, to be sure, it was not all that noticeable. But this was a world where any flaw, any scar or deformity, was a strike against one's potential for advancement. The scar added insult to injury, as far as Vistara was concerned, because of its location. The thin line almost always made her look like she was smiling, even when she wasn't. She had hated that about it, until Lady Rhea, one of the most respected of the Sith Lords, had told her that deception was actually a very useful thing indeed.
"It mars your beauty,"
Lady Rhea had said bluntly, pausing as she strolled down the line of potential apprentices after a formal ceremony.
"A pity."
She, whose beauty was only slightly diminished by the cruel ravages of time, reached out a long finger and touched the scar.
"But this little scar, it can aid you. Make others think you are something you are not."
She tapped the scar lightly with each of the last four words, emphasizing her point. That had made Vistara feel a bit better. All of a sudden, looking like she was smiling all the time, even when she wasn't, seemed like a good thing to her.
"I think I've sweated off at least 2 liters already,"
Ari replied.
"Can we continue in the training courtyard at least? It's cooler in the mountain shadows."
At least he wasn't refusing the offer of another round. Vistara dragged a black-draped arm across her own forehead. She had to admit, fighting in the cool shadows of the proud columns, beautiful statuary, and sheer mountain stone in which the temple courtyard was nestled had a definite appeal right at that moment. While they were not yet formally apprenticed to any of the Sabers or the Masters, as Tyros they would be permitted to spar in the courtyard. That was as far as they were allowed to go, however. Neither of them had seen inside the temple, or, even more significant, inside the Ship of Destiny yet. The ship's name was Omen, but the name Ship of Destiny had fallen into common usage, for such it was. Such an ancient, precious part of the tribe's heritage, with all its secrets and mysteries, was not just for any eyes.
"Well,"
Vistara said,
"we can go back and finish there, but only because you're too fragile to..."
Her teasing insult died in her throat as something passed over the sun. It was not an Uvac, one of the deceptively delicate winged reptiles that were used for aerial transportation. The star's dark brown eyes widened in shock.
"This,"
Ari said in a faint voice.
Is that a ship?"
The hairs on her arms and the back of her neck stood on end, despite the heat, as she watched, lifting a hand to shade her eyes. She still couldn't speak, but nodded. She was pretty sure that was exactly what the thing in the sky was. Yet, it looked nothing like the Ship of Destiny, or any other vessels she had seen depicted or heard described. Rather than being long and rectangular or V-shaped, it was a symmetrical sphere with wings, like an Uvac. It moved swiftly and silently, and she now saw that its color was a dark orange-red. Closer and closer it came, until for a wild moment, Vistara thought it was going to land right on the beach beside them. It was coming in for a landing, certainly, but not quite so close as that. It was heading for the sharp, rigid mountains that seemed to spring up from the ocean itself. That was where the Ship of Destiny had crashed so long ago, and for a moment, Vistara was alarmed that this vessel would suffer the same fate. Sudden worry suffused her. It couldn't. She had to know who was inside, what sort of beings they were. Perhaps they were a species she had never before encountered. The thought was thrilling. As it passed over, its shadow fell across her for an instant. A sensation of coldness, much more than the expected sudden coolness of something blocking direct sunlight, brushed Vistara. She gasped slightly as the feeling tingled through her. It was cold. Yes, forbidding. But also challenging. Curious. Intrigued. By her. She no longer was afraid for the vessel's safety. Its pilot knew exactly what it was doing. It was heading directly and quite deliberately for the ruins of the Ship of Destiny and the temple, almost as old, that had been constructed around it. Any fear or trepidation she'd experienced a moment before evaporated like water on a hot rock. Vistara reached out in the Force and summoned Tik, her Uvak. Tik had been basking in the sunlight, craving the heat, as all reptiles did. His sharp beak and brilliant green eyes closed. Now he lifted his bright gold head, stretched out his long neck, and spread his red and black ruff in the Uvak equivalent of an awakening stretch. With an answering croak, he spread his wings, leapt upward, and flew the few meters toward Vistara and Ari. She barely paid attention to Tik, keeping her eyes glued to the strange vessel as it grew smaller and finally vanished from her sight. When she could see it no longer, Vistara took a deep, steadying breath, then gathered up the long hem of her robes, turned to where Tik patiently awaited her, and began to run as fast as her long legs would carry her in the cumbersome sand, using the Force to stabilize her feet and push her along.
"Come on,"
she called over her shoulder.
"Where are we going?"
asked Ari, hastening to catch up. Vistara Force leapt upward, landing gracefully on the broad back of the Uvak. Ari followed suit, his arms slipping around her waist as he sat behind her.
"To follow the ship,"
Vistara said.
"Couldn't you feel it? It was for us, Ari."
Tik gathered himself, shifting his weight from one clawed foot to the other, then sprang upward.
"For us?"
Ari shouted over the beat of the membranous veined wings, wings so very like those of the vessel that had brushed Vistara's thoughts only a few heartbeats earlier.
"For us,"
Vistara repeated firmly. She didn't know how she knew, only that she did. The vessel had come for them, for younglings, for apprentices. It had come for Sith. It was not a very great distance as an Uvak flew to the Sith Temple. Accessible only from the air or by a perilous climb, the temple had been created to protect and watch over the Ship of Destiny and house the survivors of the crash. Vistara had visited here many times before, ever since she had become a Tyro, but she was more excited now than she had been even on her first trip so long ago. Tik's leathery wings beat steadily, and the temple came into view. It had been hewn from the very rock that had been the destruction of the Ship of Destiny, the Omen. It was very much like the Sith, Vistara thought, to take that which had been responsible for their greatest hardship and make it serve them. She knew the history of its creation, how the original Sith crew, equipped only with lightsabers and a few handheld energy weapons, had cut into the mountain's heart and shaped the spires, walls, and windows of the massive central temple. Other wings were added as the centuries crawled past. Most of the initial work had been done by the Sith, who could move huge chunks of rock with the power of the Force. Later, here and many kilometers away in the capital city of Tov, the Kashiri, Ari's people, the native humanoid species of this world, were put to work with the Sith in charge. Tov bore the stamp of a place that had been expanded by a people who had the luxury to appreciate art and beauty. The temple, while beautiful in its own right, as the first home of the Sith, was more functional than decorative. The statuary of early Sith leaders, including Captain Yaru Korsin, the first commander of the Omen, had been brought in much later, and the lovely carvings were an almost delicate counterpoint to the hard beauty of the temple architecture. Not visible from the air, but housed protectively within a special, highly secured section of the temple, was said to be the Omen itself. Some muttered that the vessel was nothing more than bits and pieces of twisted metal, preserved only for sentimental reasons. Others believed that much of what it had once been still remained, its knowledge hoarded and shared with only the select few who ascended to the lofty ranks of the Sith Lords or the Masters. But Vistara was not interested in admiring the black spires and functional, simple terraces of the temple, or the beautiful figurines of its courtyard. And for once, her thoughts did not drift toward wondering what secrets the Omen contained. This time, her eyes were on the sphere of livid orange-red that sat in the middle of the courtyard of the Sith Temple. Vistara's breath caught in her throat again, and she stared, not even wanting to blink. Suddenly, she felt as if all her life had simply been spent waiting until the moment when the spherical vessel had soared over her and caressed her with the cool brush of darkness, calling her to follow it. The ship was a perfect circle, its wings now folded in on itself, its surface rough and hard-looking. Dark side energy seemed to flow from it. Dozens of Sith were milling about in the courtyard already, and Vistara saw that more were approaching on Uvak back. She wanted to land, to leap off, to rush up to the ship and caress its knobbed, pebbly surface. A soft sob escaped her. Embarrassed, she tried to turn it into a cough, but Ari knew her too well. He tightened his arms around her waist.
"Vis, you all right?"
"Yes, of course I am. This is an unusual situation, don't you think?"
She knew that Ari was fond of her, and while she found him attractive, he was a Kashyyri male. Of course he was gorgeous. She had no desire to start a romance. For one thing, despite the fact that the Sith were firm believers in merit over birth, there was still a stigma attached to being Kashyyri. No doors were closed to them by their unfortunate birth. Indeed, one of the current High Lords was Kashyyri. But there were never marriages between them and the Sith, and they had a narrower window of opportunity to prove themselves. Some Sith did take Kashyyri lovers, of course, although the species were sufficiently different that no children could be conceived. The physical beauty of the Kashyyri was difficult to resist, but Vistara knew she would not be one of those who succumbed to it. She was utterly devoted to the Force, to her studies, to practicing and training and honing her skills, until her body quivered with weariness, until she was drenched in sweat, until she crawled into bed and slept the dreamless sleep of the exhausted. And now this ship had come, and she did not care about anything else. Again, she felt the cold perusal and shivered. Ari's arms tightened about her, mistaking the gesture for a physical chill.
"You sensed me."
I did,
she sent back through the Force. She was being examined, appraised.
"You seek to become a Sith Master, to harness the power of the dark side."
I...
Vistara straightened to her full, tall height atop Tick's back and deliberately banished her childish hesitancy. Never mind that she had never before beheld a spacefaring vessel, never even seen the diagrams and schematics that were purported to rest inside the forbidden hull of the crashed Omen. She was of the tribe, the daughter of a Sith Saber. She was exceptionally strong in the Force and knew it. And the ship... ship itself, not its pilot. She realized now it had no pilot. Not yet. Was testing her. She would not shrink before its probity.
"I do. I shall. I am Vistara Kai, daughter of a proud heritage. I have what is necessary to command the dark side and bend it to my will, to use it for the good of the tribe and the people."
"For the good of all Sith,"
Ship suggested. She nodded automatically, though even as she did so, she realized the vessel couldn't see her. Except somehow it could. Or rather, she realized, it could sense her agreement in the Force. She felt it approve, and then withdraw. Without the coldness of its presence in her mind, she somehow felt bereft. But she refrained from seeking it out again. At that moment, as her gaze wandered from ship to the throng of Sith crowding around it, in that sea of dark robes, she saw a pale blonde head turn in her direction. It was Lady Rhea, one of the members of the Sith Circle of Lords, and her blue eyes were fixed upon Vistara. Even from this height, Vistara could see that Lady Rhea's eyes were narrowed, as if she was considering something. Slowly, Vistara smiled.
Chapter 6. Aboard the Jade Shadow.
The Jade Shadow was full of all things Mara. Once or twice during the long silences that filled too many hours spent simply traveling, with the quiet, controlled hum of the engines the only sound, Ben Skywalker could have sworn he felt his mother's presence. And he did not dismiss it every time as wistful imagination. He was a Jedi, and he knew better. If her spirit was to linger or visit anywhere, surely it would be here, with her husband and son, in the ship that had been designed especially for her. In a way, it was like having almost everyone who'd cared about Mara Jade Skywalker present. Their love and labor had gone into turning an ordinary space yacht into something unique, formidable, and unexpected, like the woman for whom it was intended. The basic vessel itself had come from Lando Calrissian. Tendra, Lando's wife, had given it the name Jade Shadow. The name was ostensibly because of the vessel's hull, gray and non-reflective, but Ben thought it an apt choice. Mara's shadow was everywhere in it. With all the extras, Mara could have piloted the vessel herself. The bridge, however, was originally designed for a pilot, co-pilot, and navigator. Three, just like the Skywalker family had once been three. Upgrades, some astonishing and cutting-edge, had come. Lando and Talon Card gave the vessel teeth in the form of retractable AG-1G laser cannons and two concealed Dimech HM-8 concussion missile launchers. Each had a magazine of 8 high-yield torpedoes. The whole defense system could be controlled manually or by a targeting computer that did everything but send consolation notes back to the next of kin. The ship might be a shadow, but it was quite substantial when it came to fighting back. Han Solo himself had souped up the engines, replicating many of the tricks he'd learned over the years on his own beloved vessel, the Millennium Falcon. On top of that, he'd given the Shadow an advanced long-range sensor suite that anyone seeking to avoid detection or beat a hasty retreat would salivate over. Port and starboard visual scanners, sensor decoys, jamming devices, fake transponder codes, and what Ben had always thought of as the jewel in the crown, a remote-controlled slave circuit that summoned the Shadow over short distances. After that, Luke and Mara had worked together on many aspects of the vessel, just as they had worked together on a marriage that had been dedicated and true. They'd complimented Han's contributions by adding an autopilot capable of admirably evasive maneuvers and retrofitted the aft docking bay to accommodate a modified starfighter. Mara herself, at not insignificant cost, had installed an extremely sensitive holographic communications array that could send and receive messages all the way from the deep core to the outer rim. Ben now viewed that almost as a prescient gift, though of course Mara could not possibly have known how vital a lifeline it would one day be for her son and husband. The places Ben and Luke were going to could hardly be considered a quick trip. Ben was leaning back in the co-pilot seat, hands clasped loosely behind his head, gazing up through the transparasteel canopy at the velvet blackness punctuated by stars. "Thinking of Mom?" Luke asked quietly. Ben nodded.
"Yeah, spending so much time in her ship, it's hard not to."
"I know what you mean."
"I'm glad we took the Shadow, not just for the practical reasons."
Luke glanced over at his son and gave him a quick grin. "Me too. It feels appropriate, as if part of her is making the journey with us." Ben nodded. He didn't mention the feelings he'd had, almost as if she'd been present. If it was real, Luke was doubtless already feeling it too. If it wasn't, it was his own imagination, and he'd keep it to himself. In a way, this was a memorial journey. The immediate reasons were very pressing and very dire. They were attempting to gather information that would help demystify and hopefully cure the strange mental illness that was affecting Jedi Knight Seth Helen and Valen Horn, and also figure out what had gone so badly wrong with Jason Solo, so that Luke's 10-year exile would be commuted. But Ben was also finding that the many hours of comfortable silence or quiet conversation the journey allowed him to have with his father had been honoring Mara Jade Skywalker in some way. He knew they wouldn't have had these times together on Coruscant. In a way, Luke's exile and this journey upon which they had embarked had been, and promised to continue to be, something that brought them together, slowed things down a little bit, despite the urgency of the mission. Mara's expensive holographic communications array chimed softly. Luke frowned. Ben did too. Silgal wasn't expected to make contact for another 4 hours. One could set one's chrono by her. Luke reached forward and tapped the controls. A diminutive image of the Mon Calamari healer, about a third of a meter high, appeared on the little dais of the holoprojector. Mon Cal expressions were hard to read, but both Luke and Ben could tell from the way she moved her body that she was agitated.
Silgal, what is it? Luke asked.
Silgal inclined her head in a gesture of respect, observing the proprieties even when Luke was in exile and disgrace, even when she was obviously in distress.
Much has happened in the last few hours, Grandmaster. Shall I tell you the good news or the bad? Both are important.
Let's start with the bad news, said Luke.
Very well. There has been another incident with a Jedi Knight.
Oh, no, Luke breathed. Who?
It was Gisela Horn.
The Skywalkers exchanged glances. Two thoughts slammed into Ben's brain at once. One was, poor Gisela. The other, what's this done to their parents?
I witnessed it, Master Skywalker. She had come to the temple to assist me in researching a cure for her brother. She seemed agitated and did not appear to have slept well, but I assumed that was to be expected, considering. She was seated beside me in the research room, when suddenly she stiffened and began to make excuses for why she had to leave immediately. I realized something more than simple worry was affecting her, and attempted to engage her in conversation.
Silgal's enormous eyes blinked rapidly, a sign of agitation. Luke listened, not interrupting, and Ben followed his father's example, although he was burning to ask questions.
She rose and activated her lightsaber, accusing me of absconding with the real Silgal.
Just like Valen, Luke said.
Exactly. Then she fled the temple.
She escaped? From the temple? How? There's Jedi all over the place.
Ben had blurted the words before he could censor himself. Instead of reprimanding him, Silgal sighed.
An excellent question, Jedi Skywalker. Gisela is a trained Jedi Knight, certainly, but nonetheless, in our own temple, we ought to have been able to capture her. Master Skywalker, Gisela Horn flow-walked.
Luke looked startled. You're certain?
I am reasonably so, yes. She seemed able to know exactly where each of us would try to confront her, and took routes to avoid us. I can't think of any other explanation than her seeing into the future.
That's hardly incontrovertible evidence of flow-walking, Luke said. That could be tactics, smart use of the Force, and just plain luck. Part of being a Jedi is being able to anticipate what others will do.
It could be those simple things. Had she not known exactly where two security droids, the very droids about to be activated to attack her, were hidden and disabled them. Two of her dearest friends tried and failed to capture her when she fled the temple. They were in a tap calf right outside and came out when the fighting began. Both Basil Warv and Yakiel Sevatu report that she knew where they were going to be, knew what tactics they were going to use, and was able to counter every single blow before it landed.
Luke looked skeptical. Silgal, that's a very basic Jedi technique, anticipating your opponent, knowing what they're going to do.
Not like this. This was beyond the ordinary. It was almost choreographed, too precise. The only thing that saved Basil's life was the fact that Gisela seemed so distressed. She was not thinking clearly. Also, I felt something in the Force. Something involving time and space. I have not tried to sense when anyone is flow-walking before, but if I had to guess, that is what I would have assumed even without knowing what Gisela had done with the droids and in the fight.
Ben's eyes were enormous. Even his father was hard put to conceal his shock.
Go on, was all Luke said.
Unfortunately, as I said, Basil and Yakiel were unsuccessful in their attempt to capture her. The GA has her, and Chief of State Dalla reports that she is going to be put in carbonite.
Without even an exam or trial,
Luke said. It was a statement, not a question, and Silgal nodded.
GA security was on the scene immediately, and Dalla wasn't far behind them. And, Master, there was at least one reporter who broadcast almost everything.
Ben felt a knot in his gut. This couldn't possibly have gone worse. Unless...
Were there any casualties?
He asked.
Thankfully, no. Many civilians received injuries, most minor, and Basil was wounded. He will make a full recovery.
Ben thought that the same could not necessarily be said for Valen or Gisella.
Well, that's something to be grateful for, at least, Luke said. He rubbed his eyes. You said the attack was recorded?
Yes, transmitting the broadcast now.
Luke and Ben watched in increasingly sickened silence as one Javis Tyr.
Reporting live from just outside the Jedi Temple in Galactic City, Coruscant,
proceeded to interview passers-by while feeding them transparently leading questions. Like,
how long do you think the Jedi have been hiding this issue?
At one point, Ben actually snorted in disgust. His father might have been trying to smother a smile at the sound, but he quickly sobered as the footage continued. It was damning. There was Gisella, in full Jedi robes and brandishing a lit lightsaber, shrieking at pedestrians and force-hurling them out of her way. And the commentary as the cam zoomed around, always seeking out the perfect angle.
Another Jedi has gone crazy. She's attacking people right and left.
Gisella's hair had come undone, and dark strands flew about her head. The cam zoomed in on her at one point and revealed brown eyes wide with terror.
She does look crazy, Dad,
Ben said softly, the admission paining him. Luke said nothing, his expression sad as he stared at Corrin Horn's little girl.
Even her fellow Jedi thinks she's dangerous,
came Tyr's voice, still remarkably calm.
I can see two Jedi heading to intercept the rampaging Jedi now, and it looks like several are emerging from the temple as well.
Ben stared raptly, thinking that this was like watching a speeder crash. He couldn't tear his eyes away, even though the sight made him sick. What he saw next, he couldn't believe. A Ramoan, whom he recognized as a Jedi Knight, charged forward. He was suddenly slammed into by a fleeing pedestrian, and, apparently caught unawares by the impact, stumbled several steps to the side. And that was precisely where Gisella leapt even before he'd begun moving. Her lightsaber came down in a blur of motion, and Gisella shrieked.
It's not you!
Pause, Luke said. The recording stopped obediently.
Replay.
Both Skywalkers watched the encounter again. Ben felt a shiver chase up and down his spine. Flow walking. This was more than force anticipation. The fight continued. Ben realized that Silgall was right. At every turn, Gisella predicted exactly where Barf would be. Sometimes she seemed to be two steps ahead. Ben had never seen that kind of force anticipation, not even from his father. His skin crawled. He paid no attention now to the reporter's running commentary, only dimly aware of words like,
so young and attractive,
and tragic family, and other bantha poodoo. He was much more interested in the fight. He heard a snarl. Gisella's head whipped around.
There is another on the scene, a young Bothan Jedi who seems to...
And suddenly, the cam was flying at Gisella, who whirled. There was a perfect, beautiful shot of her insane face as she lifted the lightsaber. Then the transmission ended. Luke heaved a heavy sigh and ran his hand through his hair. While I confess I'm pleased that Yakiel was able to take out the reporter's holocam, a lot of damage has been done. I'm certain that last image of Gisella is going to be all over the news vids.
It was good thinking on Jedi Akeel's part, but it did little in the end. It turns out the reporter had a backup cam. Here's what else he was able to record.
The quality of the holovid was greatly reduced in this version, but the words came through loud and clear. There was Chief of State Dalla, as usual looking stunning for someone her age, telling everyone in a calm, reassuring voice that Gisella Horn, like her brother, would be safely imprisoned in Carbonite, that there was something going wrong with the Jedi, and that her government would investigate and explore all possible explanations. Tyr piped up with another leading question, similar to the ones he had posed to the civilians earlier. Ben uttered an oath that his mother would have winced to hear, even though she had probably taught it to him unwittingly, and Luke's lips thinned as insinuations were made that it was the Horn blood that was responsible for the madness.
"Oh, Master Horn's gonna love that," muttered Ben. "I feel really bad for him, having to listen to garbage like that. It's like rubbing salt in a wound."
"I feel bad for whoever he runs into," Luke said. Dala responded with the finesse of a natural politician, managing to smear the Jedi and the Horns both without actually saying anything that could be pointed to as inflammatory, even going so far as to chide the reporter for putting words into my mouth. Luke sighed as Dala finished up and returned to her speeder. The reporter went on to try to get quotes from Basil and Yakiel, and finally Silgal herself stepped into the frame.
"The Jedi are obviously very concerned about the current state of events, and have been since the first incident. We are doing everything we can." "I apologize, Master Skywalker,"
the live Silgal said, her gravelly voice deep with regret.
"I would have preferred not to speak for the Jedi until we had had the chance to discuss this and present a united front."
"You were on the spot. Don't worry about it," Luke assured her. "When are the Masters gathering?"
"Within the hour. The question is, how much of what the reporter said is correct?"
Ben's auburn brows drew together.
"Dad!"
He started to protest, but Luke held up a hand to forestall his comments.
"These are two Jedi who are closely related," Luke said. "That is something that's going to come up, repeatedly, and we need to have an answer for that. Is it possible that it's a genetic cause? The Horns won't like it, but I bet they'll know we need to check it out."
"What about Seth Helen?"
Ben pointed out.
"He's not a Horn, and he was the first one to have manifested any of these symptoms."
Luke smiled at his son. "Good point, and correct." He turned again to the holographic image of the Mon Calamari. "And you were right, Silgal. It certainly did look as though Gisela could have experienced flow walking. She wasn't concentrating enough to simply be landing good strategic blows." Silgal inclined her head.
"I would rather it be the latter, frankly."
"Me too."
3 for 3, Ben said.
3 for 3 what?
3 Jedi displaying the same kind of paranoid behavior and abilities they shouldn't have.
Abilities that Jason learned, but they couldn't possibly have learned themselves,"
Silgal said, nodding.
"Exactly."
Ben started counting them off on his fingers, rising his agitated body, weary of being in the confined space, needing to move to assist his thinking.
1. Seth was able to freeze his adversaries and snatch their weapons from them in the middle of a fight. 2. Valen was able to fake a seizure, alter the impressions his brainwaves emitted well enough to fool everyone. And 3, Gisela flow-walked. It's circumstantial evidence, but it's the best we've got right now. It's the only common thread I'm able to see.
Ben paused and turned around to see both the holographic Silgal and his father staring at him. He flushed a little, wondering if he'd been babbling, but he saw approval in his father's blue eyes.
"Agreed. Your decision to explore the connection with Jason appears, tragically, to continue to be validated. We still have no indication that Jason had any sort of contact with these 3 Jedi Knights."
"But there's gotta be a link,"
Ben blurted, then amended.
"Well, logic dictates that there should be anyway."
"The Baron Doe sages weren't able to shed any light on this," Luke said. "I wonder if we're not hurting the wrong nerve, chasing the wrong lead."
He leaned back in his chair, his eyes narrowed, thinking.
"A link with Jason?"
Luke's eyes widened.
"No, not Jason. At least, not with the physical one."
"But there's been no trace of him in the Force,"
Ben reminded his father. As always, the thought saddened him. For all the rage he'd once borne toward his late cousin, Ben had learned to forgive him. Although, like Luke, he still needed to understand what had happened to him. For a few seconds at the end, Jaina had assured them all he'd been Jason again, not Darth Kydus, and Ben had loved Jason. Ben felt an uncomfortable, slightly awkward sorrow, as if something left forever unresolved at the thought of never sensing his presence again. Luke shook his head.
"That's not what I meant," he said,
and his voice held a trace of the same sorrow that Ben was feeling. I was wondering if Kaidus somehow was able to see that his reign as a Sith would eventually come to an end. And if he saw that, maybe this entire situation is something he set up by flow-walking into the past. Ben stared at his father, wide-eyed.
You can do that?
Luke's face showed disapproval. You can influence the future to a certain degree, yes. Kaidus didn't have the chance to find and train an apprentice to carry on his work after he was killed. He couldn't break you, and he wasn't able to fully corrupt Tahiri. Maybe he took this route to leave a legacy of some sort. Ben had followed Jason more than a slight way down a very dark path, but he had not gone to the dark side. He knew that Kaidus had thought him too weak. In the end, though, he'd learned to realize that what Kaidus had dismissed as weakness was that which the Jedi realized was their greatest, truest strength.
I imagine it would be possible,
Silgal was saying, distaste evident in her voice.
It certainly bears investigation, unsettling an idea as it is.
He did study with the Ang-Ti,
Ben offered. At one point, he'd known just about every place Jason had been during his 5-year galaxy-hopping adventure. He desperately wanted to emulate it, and now it was beginning to look as though he was going to, under far different and much sadder circumstances.
Maybe we should go talk to them.
Silgal gave a raspy, gurgling laugh.
That will be much easier said than done. The Ang-Ti are notoriously unwelcoming of strangers, and there's very little information about them even in the temple files.
I think Ben is right, Luke said. It's more than just investigating a force trick that Jason used. The flow-walking could be the key to understanding the entire situation. If Kaidus flow-walked and laid this mental instability as some sort of bomb rigged to go off if he failed, then understanding how he did it may help us understand how to undo it. I know we don't have a lot of information on the Ang-Ti, but please send me whatever you find.
They live in the Kaithal Rift. That much I know,
Silgal offered. She sighed and closed her large eyes for a moment.
I'll send you everything I learn, Grandmaster.
Luke whistled softly. The Kaithal Rift. I'll need everything you can learn then. This just keeps getting better and better.
What's so bad about the Kaithal Rift?
Ben asked. I'll tell you later, Luke said. Thank you, Silgal. Now, didn't you say there was some good news? I think I could use it along about now. Silgal smiled faintly.
Ben mentioned Seth Helen earlier. I am pleased to report that he has been captured by the Jedi. We are currently holding him deep within the temple for analysis.
Well, that is good news. Does the GA or Dala have any idea about this?
None whatsoever. Jaina, Tahiri, Mirax, Winter, and Jag took him down.
Tahiri?
Ben was pleased. He knew Tahiri Vela hadn't been willing to fully rejoin the Jedi, but he was glad to know that she was cooperating with them.
Indeed. It would seem that she is not opposed to aiding us. Perhaps she will decide to rejoin at some point.
Ben hoped so. It had been his choice to spare Tahiri, believing she could come to her senses, be redeemed. Silgal hesitated.
I said that the GA and Dala do not know about Seth's capture, nor do any of the Masters save myself. No one has any desire to place Master Hamner in a compromising position.
Luke frowned, then nodded. If this comes out, he can in all honesty deny any knowledge of it, and the Order is not affected. I still don't like it. He sighed, and then shook his head, seeming to refocus on the matter at hand. What have you learned about Seth so far?
He does not demonstrate Valen's ability to blank the encephalus scan, and thus we were able to successfully take brain scan readings. The parts of his brain that are active while dreaming also appear to be active while he is awake, to a certain extent. In other words, there is a definite dream state occurring, although he is wide awake and cognizant of what is going on. Our investigation continues.
Investigation. Even Silgal was starting to use Ben's terms. Ben suddenly was hurled back in time in his mind to when Master Silgal had been conducting the investigation into the murder of Mara Jade Skywalker. The detachment had helped. Ben had burned with the desire to do everything exactly right, so that the investigation into his mother's death wouldn't be compromised. He'd been the one to prove what had happened to her, even when things seemed to point in another direction entirely. And now, here was another investigation. Not into a murder, but into something that was most assuredly a mystery. "What is his behavior like?" Luke asked.
"Exactly as you'd expect. He thinks everyone's been taken and replaced by doubles. He's scared and angry and determined to kill us all. Captain Solo and Jedi Organa Solo will be arriving within a few hours to offer what insight they can, as they were the ones who encountered Seth Helen first."
"I remember," Luke said. "I'm not sure they will be able to give us any additional insight, but who knows? Anything else?"
"I would have thought that this would be quite sufficient for one conversation, but if you insist, I'm sure I can come up with something else."
Luke laughed. The sound surprised Ben. There was so much bad that was going on, it seemed hard to find anything to be amused about. But now Silgall was grinning too, and he mentally shrugged. "No, I think you're right," Luke said. "That's more than enough for one day. Let me know when you find anything on the Yang-Ti, and brief me after the council meeting. In the meantime, Ben and I will set course for the Kaithal Rift." He hesitated, then added, "And please give my deepest sympathies to Corrin and Mirax. This is an especially difficult time for them."
"Of course, Master Skywalker."
Silgall inclined her hairless head. Her image disappeared. Luke settled back in the chair, folding his arms behind his head. His blue eyes were distant, unfocused. Ben held his tongue for a while, but finally he couldn't help himself.
"Do you really think that Jason, that Kydus set all this up?" he asked. "The Jedi going crazy, the stuff they know, do you really think he planned all this?"
Luke sat back up and began laying in a course for the Kaithal Rift. "It's a possibility, and it would explain a lot."
"Wouldn't explain how he was able to actually do it."
"With any luck, we'll find the Yang-Ti in a congenial frame of mind, and they'll choose to enlighten us." Ben couldn't help what escaped his lips next.
"Do you think we'll have to flow walk in order to find out?"
"I hope not, Ben. I truly hope not."
Chapter 7. Aboard the Jade Shadow.
"You know," Ben grumbled, "when I said I wanted to come with you, I didn't realize that I was signing up for the mobile chapter of the Academy."
Luke, his eyes on the holographic star chart that looked like someone had spilled watered down blue milk all over it, chuckled softly. "Studying is good for you," he said.
"Builds character."
He adopted an old man's creaky voice.
"Why, when I was your age, my young apprentice, all I wanted to do was go to the Academy, uphill both ways in a sandstorm."
"Yeah, Uncle Han told me about that,"
Ben retorted, his own mouth twitching as he suppressed a grin.
"You didn't want to get a good education. You wanted to hang out with your friends."
It was a bittersweet joke. Luke indeed had ended up flying with his best friend, Biggs Darklighter, but under completely different circumstances. It had not been a joyride or race or friendly competition. It was an assault on the Death Star, and it had cost the lives of everyone in the Red Squadron except Wedge Antilles and Luke Skywalker. But Luke smiled fondly at the comment. The memories he held of Biggs were all good ones. Biggs had not been the first to die for a cause he devoutly believed in, and he wouldn't be the last. But he died making a difference, and that was the way Luke knew his friend had wanted it. So it was easy for Luke to shoot back to his son. "Too bad you don't have any close friends that aren't your family. Maybe you'll become friends with an Yang-Ti kid." Ben grimaced.
"I'm not too sure about that."
A few hours before, Silgall had transmitted everything she had been able to learn so far about the Kaithal Rift and the Yang-Ti. It wasn't a lot, but the two Skywalkers had divvied up the research between them. Luke had given Ben the information on the Yang-Ti, while he had studied the complex and extremely dangerous spatial phenomenon that was the Rift. Ben was certainly a capable pilot, though one could always be better, and Luke had often given his son the helm during the journey in order for Ben to have more flying hours under his belt. But the rift was something else again, and Luke felt more comfortable managing it himself. It was difficult to navigate for a whole host of reasons. To begin with, it was huge, a cloud of wildly unstable gases, the birthplace of thousands of stars, that was several parsecs wide. Several parsecs was about as precise as one could be, considering that the cloud was constantly shifting. At first glance, this place of powerful electromagnetic light storms and sensor-distorting radiation seemed impossible to traverse. But the Yang-Ti, who were thought to live on one of the thousands of planets believed to lie inside the rift, seemed to navigate it just fine. Uncannily fine, as a matter of fact. They seemed completely able to avoid the light storms that were quite capable of destroying entire fleets of ships in a matter of minutes. And by all accounts, their vessels appeared untouched by particle buildup that could render sensors pretty much useless and weapon systems utterly non-functional. They could do this because there were currents in the rift. The literature referred to them as corridors that twined throughout the stunningly beautiful, colorful, and incredibly dangerous gas cloud. The trick was that the corridors changed position, frequently. One report stated that they changed as often as dozens of times in a 24-hour day. The logical conclusion was that there was some kind of predictable pattern to how and when these corridors shifted, and that the Yang-Ti had figured out the mystery. So far, though, no one else had, at least no one whose recollections and observations could be found in the Jedi archives. Even if one did happen upon one of the corridors, no pilot or crew could possibly call such a passageway safe. These areas were simply less dangerous than the rest of the rift because the concentration of radiation and charged particles was slightly less. Moving through the Kaithal Rift for non-Yang-Ti vessels meant placing one's ship in constant danger. Even in the corridors, weapons ranges were cut in half, shields were weakened, and as for communication systems, Luke figured he might as well resign himself to not hearing from Silgall again once they entered, even with Mara's incredibly sophisticated equipment upgrades. Then, once they did enter the rift, they'd be targets. Not just for the xenophobic Yang-Ti, who were infamous for disliking anyone sticking their noses into their business, but for the energy discharges of the rift itself. A ship acted like a lightning rod, so for the entire duration of their trip, the Jade Shadow would be pounded by energy bolts. It would be quite a show visually, but an extremely bumpy ride. And there was another reason the rift was so dangerous. A stigma was attached to the place. A stigma that went above and beyond the fact that it was simply a bad place for a ship to be. Silgall had seen fit to enclose in her transmission a whole host of first-person reports that came uncomfortably close to being classified as ghost stories. At first, Luke was confused as to why Silgall had included them. He was inclined to lump them into the same categories as cabin fever and space sickness, but then he realized that report after report insisted that force sensitives were more strongly affected than others. Most planets here would not thrive particularly well, Luke supposed. The constant high levels of radiation were not